Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, if you've never experienced shyness, you'll never understand just how painful it can be for some people. For many, it becomes debilitating, and without help, it stops them living to their potential. Award-winning psychotherapist Dr. Barton Goldsmith joins us around 12:40 to share confidence-gaining strategies and tips from his latest book, 100 Ways to Overcome Shyness. We'll also talk with Jim Fannin, a high-performance coach to pro athletes, celebrities, and Fortune 500 executives, about the power of the 90-second rule, which can be applied to any aspect of your life, and we'll learn more about that later. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome someone who's going to show us the way to a child's joy. Anne Gadzikowski has more than 25 years of experience in early childhood education. She's the author of several books in early childhood development and a frequent presenter at education conferences. She currently serves as the early childhood coordinator for Northwestern University's Center for Talent Development. And the name of her new book is called Creating a Beautiful Mess, 10 Essential Play Experiences for a Joyous Childhood. Anne Gadzikowski, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be talking to you today.
And this is one of my favorite subjects, as I said to you before we came live. Play. I think play is so important to all of us, regardless of age. But I'm wondering, you've been doing this for a long, long time. You actually start out the book saying that many books on this very topic take a defensive posture. But you, right out of the gate, say, I'm taking an offensive posture, ready to score, prepared to rack up an easy victory on behalf of team play. So tell us about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think everyone enjoys play. It's a universal experience. I think we all played when we were children. Children from every culture play. Children have always played as far back in history as we can look. So I think it is definitely a universal experience that everybody enjoys. And hopefully as adults, we're still enjoying play. But I think as parents, we have such a wonderful opportunity to revisit the joy of play that we remember from our own childhood and experience that with our children. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I often get questions from parents who wonder if play is still the same now as it was when they were little. And sometimes they have trouble recognizing that there are still so many similarities between the way children play now and the way they did, you know, a generation ago.
Yeah. I was thinking about that as I was reading the book, because I'm looking at, you know, my niece is in her early, I think she's 31. The toys that her children are playing with are very different to the toys that she played with, and really different to the ones that I played with. So I can see that, you know, there might be confusion there for parents about, you know, what exactly is play now? And let's just define that from the get-go.
Well, I think I take a really open-ended definition of play. I mean, I think it's anything that brings you great pleasure that really has no specific purpose. You're not trying to accomplish a specific task. You're not getting work done. It's very free. I know there are other more academic definitions of play, but I keep it pretty open-ended. And I think the reason why parents wonder if it's the same now as it used to be is because of technology, mm-hmm. because so many children are playing with tablets and they're playing with smartphones, and those are the devices that are so new to us, and we don't recognize them as playthings. But there really are so many other ways to play, and I think through the book, I'm gently reminding parents that there are other toys besides tablets and smartphones. There are other exciting ways that children can play. Even though they seem so drawn to the technology, they really will enjoy other kinds of play when they have the opportunity and they're exposed to other kinds of play.
Yeah. I love that you have a balance in here, because you're definitely not anti-tech. You say there's a good balance there, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, you're talking about small children having cell phones today, because I know my nephews and nieces all had cell phones at the age of 6 and 7. You know, I had a toy plastic phone at the age of 6 and 7 with an intercom that I thought was just the best thing, you know. So we'll take a very quick break. And then when we come back, I want to get into a little bit more of some of the issues you cover in the book. And there were some surprises in here for me. So I'd like to talk about those when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Anne Gadzikowski. Her book is called Creating a Beautiful Mess, 10 Essential Play Experiences for a Joyous Childhood.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, New York Times bestselling novelist Meg Waite discusses the race for Paris, based on a true wartime story. It's an engrossing and heartbreaking story of friendship, love, and sacrifice. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. For podcasts, visit conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we're talking here about finding a child's pathway to joy. My guest, Anne Gadzikowski, says that is through play. And you do talk in the book, Anne, about finding that balance between technology and simple play. One of the things that I actually was surprised that is really important, you say, is building with blocks. So talk to us about why that is so important, because it does seem, you know, a very basic, very kind of antiquated way of play today.
I became newly interested in block play and construction play when I started working in my position that I'm in now at Northwestern University, where we develop enrichment programs for children in math and science and engineering. And I saw how the children who have the opportunity to play with blocks and to build things out of Legos, that they develop very complex understandings of how things work and how things fit together. I could really see that there's a clear connection between these kinds of play experiences and the way children understand their world. And I think that they need those kinesthetic experiences, using their hands and their bodies to build and construct. I love wooden blocks because they are usually unfinished, and they're a nice kind of medium weight that children can work with, but they don't necessarily lock together, so they have to think about how gravity works and how the pieces are going to stay and be aligned. So there's just so much that the children learn and gain, and they're not necessarily articulating that as they speak, but we can see as they grow, the more experience they have with these kinds of construction materials, the more sophisticated their understanding of the world and about engineering and math in particular.
Yeah, see, there's a lot more to it than just stacking blocks on top of one another when you talk to somebody who's, you know, in that field. I noticed on your blog that you are about to go to Denmark, or have you been by now?
I just got back,
so
two days ago.
Tell us about that, because that was kind of interesting. You went out to talk about Girl Power STEM, an acronym. And you said you took a close look at the history of Lego and the efforts of that company to engage both boys and girls. So talk to us about that and why that's important.
Yeah, I'm very interested in encouraging girls to participate more in science and technology and engineering and math. I know from my own experience, I grew up with two brothers, and we had blocks in the house. And no one ever said to me out loud, the blocks are for boys. But I always had the sense that they belonged to my brothers. They weren't really mine. And I think a lot of girls have that experience. They're either told directly or they get an impression from the way things are around them that they're not as welcome with those kinds of learning experiences with math and technology and science. So I've been very interested in my work with developing opportunities for girls to feel more confident and to gain more experience in these fields. And I work with such young children that really it's the play experiences, it's the blocks, and as I said, Legos and other kinds of construction materials that are going to draw them in to that kind of play and that kind of learning. And since this conference was in Denmark, and that's the home of the Lego company, I took a close look at the Lego company's history, and I noticed that one of their very first statements of mission or the values for their company as a toy company was to make sure that they served both boys and girls. But I've heard a lot of criticism recently, say in the last 10 years, about how a lot of the Legos are kind of color-coded, like there are the blue and the black Legos, the Star Wars Legos, those are boys, and then there are the pink and the purple Legos, and those are for girls. Mm. And girls may not feel as welcome playing with Legos now as they maybe did when I was a kid, and they were just primary color Legos. So it seems like there are some subtle messages to children
yeah.
about gender, and there's been a lot in the media about that lately.
I actually just heard that Target is going to stop breaking down toys into boys' shelves and girls' shelves.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's good. And I have to tell you, one of my favorite toys ever, and I'd still love it today, my brother had a 007 briefcase. And it had a hidden camera in there, and if you pressed the secret button on the handle, it would take a picture.
Cool.
So, I mean, he played with our toys, we played with his toys, so I think we get hung up on that too much.
Yeah, and I think parents understand that. I think every parent I've ever talked to closely about this really understands that the toys are really for everyone, and there are a lot of things that you can do at home to encourage, children to experiment with all different kinds of toys and play experiences. That's the whole message of the book, is a balance.
Right.
Of all different kinds of experiences, not
right.
all just one type.
Right. So let's talk about pretending and make-believe. Is there such a thing as taking that too far?
Not in my experience, no. I have not seen that. What I see more often is teachers and parents discouraging children from pretending that they've outgrown that. But the progression that you see as children grow in their play, and if you look at it from a child development perspective, you understand how this fits in with their cognitive growth, how their brains are growing. So they start out, say a two-year-old is pretending to be mommy or pretending to be daddy, and she's pretending to talk on a cell phone, or she's cooking dinner or driving a car. But as the children get older, their pretend play becomes much more fantastical, where they're superheroes or they have magic powers. And this is a really important milestone in their cognitive growth and their thinking, because now they're able to imagine things that aren't really there in front of them. They're thinking much more abstractly, and they're creating very elaborate stories. So I think this is a really important part of human development, and mm-hmm. we're always creating stories. We just use different tools to do it. Maybe we're watching a story on television, or we're reading a book, or we're writing a letter or an email and telling a story of what happened to us to someone who lives far away. So we're always telling stories, and make-believe is the way the children learn how to do it as they're growing up.
Right. And you do have a section in the book on digital storytelling and digital play. So it doesn't have to exclude tech when we're talking about make-believe and storytelling.
Right. Yeah, because those are really important storytelling tools as well. But you have to find good tools. There are so many apps for children now, and there are a lot of really bad ones.
Right.
I really encourage parents to use good resources of for reviews of apps and games. So Common Sense Media is one that I recommend. That's a great website for parents to look up an app or look up a game and see how it's rated and see what its benefits are. I like the idea of thinking of an app or a computer game, thinking about whether it's a playground or whether it's a playpen. Like a playpen, of course, that has a negative connotation. It's just a little enclosure, just keeping the children busy while you're cooking dinner. But a playground is open, and there are a lot of choices for children. There are a lot of different kinds of experiences for children. It's a place where they can make up their own way of playing. So if the app can do that, if the app can be a playground and not a playpen, then it's probably a pretty good app.
So let's talk about books, since we cover so many books on our show. And let's talk about the ones that really help to stretch a child's imagination. Because, again, there's some really good books out there and there's some really pretty awful ones out there.
That's true. I am really a big fan of fairy tales and folk tales. There are so many great stories, usually old stories, that can be told in more than one way. And in the book, I encourage parents, when they take their child to the children's section in the library, to not just visit the picture book section, but to also visit the folk and fairy tale section. They're shelved in a different area. Mm-hmm. But then you can find a story, fairly simple fairy tale that a young child can understand, like the Three Little Pigs. But you can find five or six or more different versions of that same story told by a different author with different illustrations. And that sends a really strong message to the children that stories can be told in so many different ways. And especially with television and with a lot of the technology concerns that we're talking about, children sometimes get the message that there's only one way to do something. And I think it's really important for their growth, for their creativity, for their understanding of other people in the world, that they know that there are all different kinds of ways to make a story, and they can tell a story their own way.
Mm. A couple of things that you say are critical components to play, sensory play and risky play. I wonder if you'd talk about those and why they're so important.
Yeah, well, sensory play is so important that that's what the book was named after. Creating a Beautiful Mess is actually one of the chapters in the book where I write about messy play involving clay and water and sand. And we call it sensory play because it's our fingers and our hands are touching, but also we're feeling the textures, and there's all different kinds of senses involved with that kind of play. And that's so important for really young children for learning about the world. And it's also really, I think it's really soothing kind of play, especially with clay. You give a child a little bit of dough or a little bit of flour and water while you're cooking dinner and let them play with it. That's going to keep them busy for a long time. They really enjoy messing around with that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also mentioned risky play, which I'm thinking more for older children, and the outdoor play. I think playgrounds are not quite as much fun as they used to be when I was little in the way that they're designed. I remember there was a slide at the park near my house. I think it was probably three stories tall. It had this curvy ladder that went all the way up into the sky, and you just wouldn't see that now. It's
right.
Tall. There are liability risks. There are regulations now that keep people from building playgrounds like that. But what's missing, it's not that I think children should not be safe. In fact, in my work with children, I have a reputation. I have a nickname called the Safety Queen because I'm usually quite a stickler about safety issues in my work.
Right.
But I do admire programs that have found opportunities or playgrounds that have found ways for children to test themselves a little bit, to be able to climb up a little bit higher and run a little bit faster and not have someone say, oh, be careful, you're going to fall down. And a really good example of that I wrote about in the book are adventure playgrounds, which are much more common in Europe and especially in England where they were developed,
mm-hmm.
where children can construct their own playground equipment out of planks and bricks and old tire wheels, and they can even build a campfire and do other kinds of things that we would think, oh, children can't do that. So it's a good reminder to us that there are other things that children might not get a chance to explore on an ordinary playground. Right. We don't want them to get hurt. We don't want them to do dangerous things. But children actually, I think if we trust them a little bit more, they'll make good choices. When I see children climbing on a playground, you know, almost always they'll stop when they get to a point where they feel a little scared or a little uneasy. They'll start to make those choices themselves if we give them a chance to figure it out.
Right. And very quickly, because we're right at the end of our segment, we've only got a minute here, Anne, but I wonder if you'd just talk about the importance of humor and, you know, how parents engage with their children. Because you see some parents who just get down on the floor and play and others who do not.
Yes. Well, I think we all can laugh and have fun with our children, even if we're not, you know, especially gifted with an outrageous sense of humor. So in the book, I remind parents about just making funny faces and telling really simple jokes like knock-knock jokes and just goofing around, and how important that is for our relationships with young children and how fun it is.
It is fun. They do say the great man retains his child heart, and I buy into that wholeheartedly.
Yes.
So a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Just that childhood is just so fun. I mean, I as a parent myself, I just love being able to relive childhood through my own child as she grew up. And instead of being stressed and worried about doing the wrong thing and, you know, am I being a good parent, just let your child show you how to play. Let your child show you the joys of childhood. And if we give them that space, I think they will.
Mm. Well, I think this is a really great book for parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and, you know, anybody who works in your field. It's called Creating a Beautiful Mess, 10 Essential Play Experiences for a Joyous Childhood. And would you please give out your website, Anne?
Yes, it's anngadzikowski.com, and that's spelled anngadzikowski.com.
Thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to learn more about the power of the 90-second rule. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
When I hear children at play, memories come from far away, taking me holding my hand to the playground wonderland.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki@VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol.
Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, New York Times bestselling novelist Meg Waite discusses The Race for Paris, based on a true wartime story. It's an engrossing and heartbreaking story of friendship, love, and sacrifice. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM. For podcasts, visit conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Proud to bring variety to your radio dial. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
To the playground, Wonderland.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My next guest is Jim Fannin. He's known as America's Zone Coach. He's produced many champions in life, in business and sports. And he's a mental performance coach, author, professional speaker, life strategist, sports and business consultant, and former professional tennis player. And he was just sharing that story with me before we came live here. Jim Fannin, welcome.
Thanks, Vicki. Glad to be on your show.
And I want to let listeners know your latest book is 90 Seconds to a Great Relationship. We're going to talk a little about the power of the 90-second rule. And I want to just feed into from the segment we just talked about, because you said you have a great segue story.
Well,
there.
You know, I did some research, Vicki, decades ago on how to maximize super learning in children. And we're the ones that found out and that you and I and all the listeners learn more from birth to 5 years old than the rest of our life accumulative. That's a staggering fact, and I was kind of blown away by that research. From birth to five, we're in the moment almost 80% of our waking hours, and so we're absorbing mass quantities of information and mimicking everything and asking questions as soon as we learn how to talk. Fortunately, super learning takes hold when you're in the moment. And unfortunately, when you went to school, here comes the past. I told you not to do that. Here comes the future. And your thoughts go from a daily quantity of about 12 to 1,400 thoughts, with most being in the present, to when you're first grade and beyond into adulthood, 2,000-3,000 thoughts a day, with the majority not in the present, but in the past and the future. And I think that's what happens to relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, you have two people come together, and with 2,000 thoughts, that's 4,000 for the entire couple, and love is bliss, and everything's great, and I miss you, and I can't wait to see you. And then we get married, we have children, we have a life, we have finances, we have bills, and our thoughts increase at an incredible proportion, and with social media, they just keep going up and up, and the next thing we know, there's disconnection, and we're in the same house, but we have two different agendas, so even finding time for each other, that becomes a quest and something everyone needs to do.
Yeah, it's a universal problem for people today. So you have what you call the 90 seconds rule, and you've applied this across many aspects of life. Just give us a quick synopsis, if you would, of what you mean by the 90 second rule.
Well, as far as success goes, there's only one rule, and that's there are no rules. But what I've found is that you can make any decision in your life in less than 90 seconds. Your intuition really knows information on a quantum level that your conscious mind might not know, your gut feel. So you can make these decisions swiftly. Some you may need to sleep on it, like, do I need to get married right now, or something major in your life, you may need to sleep on it. But almost every decision, especially if you're in adverse situations, they can be made in seconds, and 90 seconds. And that's what I found that the best under pressure, that's what they do. They're incredible decision makers, very decisive. And that's what this book is about, 90 Seconds to a Great Relationship. Once you understand the basics of how your mind works and how two minds come together as one, you can upgrade and improve and change your relationship with the 90 seconds here, 90 seconds there. It'll take
right.
less than 2% of your waking hours to really change your relationship.
Right. And so, look, let's just be clear for anybody who's coming in halfway through this, but you're not saying, you know, it only takes 90 seconds to make a great relationship. You're saying we can choose to make a great contribution to our relationship in 90 seconds, which, of course, is
going to... I'll give you a very specific example. You love your significant other, and you're at work, and she or he is at work, and you haven't seen each other at least 2 hours. And now you're both coming home, or one's already home. That first 90 seconds that you've been away from someone you care about and love at least 2 hours, that first 90 seconds, Vicki, it has more impact on your relationship than you spending hours and hours with them later. Put down your cell phone. Turn your brain off. Close the door on the arena that you just were in. And give full attention in that first 90 seconds. There are several techniques within that 90 seconds. One is look your significant other in the eye long enough to discern eye color. Sounds pretty simple. But the listeners, if you'll do that when you get home, you're going to find, wow, I don't do that all the time. And there's a technique inside that 90 seconds called mirroring. So if they're sad, then you reflect their sadness. You don't want to be sad, but go down to that level so you can bring them up into a positive state. And if they're happy, it's like, wow, what's going on? Why are you so happy? What's happened? Tell me about it. So that first 90 seconds is impactful. And if you have little children, hold them up. Don't hug them. You know, they all run to dad. They all run to mom. Hold them up and say, hold on, let me hug mommy, or let me hug daddy, whichever. That way you can train your children how to treat a significant other in an awesome way 20 years later, hopefully, or 30 years later, depending on how young your children are. But you're also showing them how to respect mom or respect dad.
Right.
And, you know, I have clients that have used this 90-second rule in their life. It's been around the world, this one tool of the 90-second rule. I even have someone that's put the 90-second rule on a board on their back door where all family members go in, and all family members use the 90-second rule.
Yeah, I really believe that myself. I do believe that's a hugely powerful way to be in a relationship. The other thing that I think is important you've got here is the goodbye 90-second rule, because I personally find this really strange, but I know there are families out there where people just walk out the house, they don't say goodbye, they don't say where they're going, they don't say when they'll be back. But I think saying goodbye is important, too.
Well, it is, and unfortunately, there's been some sad cases. Oh, I wish I would have given a goodbye. You know, something tragic happened, God forbid. But, you know, Vicki, a goodbye, it takes less than 90 seconds. But you hug someone, you look them in the eye, and, you know, you really, I'm going to miss you. I'll see you. We did that when we dated. There's no question. We did that when we dated our significant other, but you know, over time, we take the hellos and the goodbyes for granted. There's another 90 seconds, Vicki, that's in the book. I think it's crucial. If you violate it, your relationship will go in the opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what research has said. This was proven, I believe this 40-some years, but it was proven several years ago by some researchers. Every thought you have during the day is recorded, and it's replayed at night. One time, every now and then twice. And the purpose of the replay is to store the information. However, in the last 30 minutes before you go into a deep REM state, whatever you think, whatever you feel, That's also recorded. But, Vicki, it's replayed 15 to 20 times during the night.
Wow.
And you wonder why you have a bad night's sleep.
Right.
You go to bed thinking negative about your spouse who may be lying in bed with you, or you're thinking something negative. You think it five times during that 30 minutes. You know, you put it down, you come back to it, you kind of put it on a little loop. That's replayed 15, 20 times per thought. You do that over 7 to 10 days, it'll program your subconscious to manifest itself into its physical equivalent. And in my opinion, this is the greatest discovery in my personal lifetime. You know, I'll be 66 my next birthday. It's the most profound thing that I've learned, and it's quantifiably proven. So, you know, Mom and Dad, they were right. Go to bed happy, wake up happy, but you never go to bed mad, and this is why. So even if one spouse is not on your page in terms of getting back to reconnecting, you need to go there by yourself. Mentally, you're putting your hand out and say, come with me.
Mm-hmm.
But one of you has to go there. One of you has to flip the script on the relationship to take it to that next level.
Mm. Yeah, makes perfect sense. Well, you've got a lot of 90-second tips here to a great relationship, the power of the 90-second rule. And I love this. You say the words of your goodbye, and that applies to hello, too. Last longer when delivered with your eyes. I love that. Final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Jim?
Well, you can change anything in your life. And the one thing I know that you really need to change is the math formula of your relationship. 1 + 1 should at least equal 3. You and I together should equal more than a part. And that's a math formula I really wish for every person listening that's in a relationship. Upgrade it. Take it to a next level. And you may only be 90 seconds away.
Love it.
So check me out at jimfannin.com. I'd love to send you my book. And hope everybody can get into the zone, that purposeful, calm feeling where nothing can go wrong.
There we go. Jim Fannin, thank you so much for being with us today. 90 Seconds to a Great Relationship. The Power of the 90-Second Rule is the book. And you can find out more about Jim and the work that he does. He's done some amazing work over the years at jimfannin.com. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Shyness is nice, and shyness can stop you from doing all the things in life you'd like to.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Burlingame Veterinary Consulting, we cover the world of animals. This week, August 23rd, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. As an animal behavior therapist and trainer, I help so many people understand their animals and solve the problems they're having with them on a private basis that I can help you too, for free, but only if you call in. I'm planning a surprise or two as well. For Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 11.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Alternative to what? Alternative to everything else out there on the radio. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Shyness is nice, and shyness can stop you from doing all the things in life you'd like to.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And where Eric Ryder found a song about shyness from, I just don't know. Who was that, Eric? You should tell us who that was.
That was the Smiths. And okay. I think that's the shyness anthem. It's called Ask.
Okay, there you go then. Well, that's what we're talking about now. And I said at the top of the hour, if you've never felt shy, people just don't understand how painful and how difficult life can be. For those who do suffer with shyness, it can be almost debilitating for some. And we have an expert here with us today. He's Dr. Barton Goldsmith. He's honored by several professional associations. He's a multi-award-winning psychotherapist, syndicated columnist, author, and former NPR radio host, as well as a keynote speaker and top blogger for Psychology Today. He was named one of America's top therapists by Cosmopolitan, and he's written a great new book called 100 Ways to Overcome Shyness, Go from Self-Conscious to Self-Confident. Dr. Barton Smith, Goldsmith, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And I should
love Seattle.
Yes, love it, love it, love it. And I should say that you co-authored this book with Marlena Hunter.
Correct.
And she has a degree in psychology and several years of experience in clinical settings as a therapist, too. So I always like to mention the co-author, even though she's not with us today. So
That's a good idea. I always do, too.
So let's just begin with this. Because it takes a lot of effort to put a book together. Why did you become interested enough in shyness to write a book about overcoming it?
Well, there's two really, really good reasons. One is I'm an odd duck. I'm a shy extrovert. And it's always difficult for me when I go to do a speech. The night before, there's almost always a meet and greet kind of cocktail party. And it's very difficult for me because I don't know anybody there. I'm maybe a little bit by the person that hired me, but, you know, I really don't know anyone or what to talk about. And so I've had to learn how to be comfortable in situations where literally there's a room full of people all looking at me, all wanting to talk to me and say hello, and I have no idea who they are. Not any information about them whatsoever. So I've become a master at asking questions.
There you go.
And that's how I've overcome it in that particular situation. And the other reason I wrote the book is because the editors at Career Press and Michael Pye asked me to. And I thought that was a very high compliment, so I dove into it.
Yeah. So there are many different reasons for somebody being shy. But I'm wondering, as a therapist, if you see what are the most common reasons behind somebody's shyness?
Social anxiety, the fear of rejection, is probably if you had to pick the biggest, the largest group, that's probably the reason. And it's not that a person hasn't been properly socialized. People can develop a social anxiety. You can be fine, and all of a sudden something triggers you that reminds you perhaps of a traumatic event in your past, and you suddenly become socially anxious and don't want to go out. And if that continues, if you allow that to continue, as you said earlier, it's a very, very painful life. Isolation is a very painful life.
Right. So let's look at how we can help people who are suffering from this. You know, listeners may have it themselves, may be shy themselves, or may, you know, live with people who are shy. I've had periods in my life for some reason, and I'm guessing this is probably true of most people, where they go through a shy period. Is that true?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, because I can remember being very extroverted, and then I went through a really shy period when I was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, something like that.
And what was that like?
Horrible.
You remember it. I mean, you actually remember it.
I know.
That must That must have, so it must have been pretty significant for you.
But I remember my aunt who told me off for being shy because she said it was conceited to be so shy because I never could figure that one out, but never mind.
Now, that's a very interesting way that I've never looked at shyness as being conceited. So, I mean, everybody's got their own, you know, their own reasons, but you know, most children will go through a period of shyness when they're growing and they're feeling awkward, and you know, anytime any adult feels awkward, they're going to go through a period of shyness. Even very social people have that moment, you know, in the beginning when they take that breath and go, "Hey, great to meet you." You know, but one of the things that you have to do is at least realize that you are a shy person, and if it has hampered your life, it dampened you socially, and you want to change that, you've got to make the admission that you're shy. That's the first step, identifying the problem, always.
Okay, so that sounds good. So then let's look at that biggest group that you said, which is a fear of rejection and that anxiety around that. How can we work to stop that becoming such a big issue in our life? Because I can see that, you know, that can lead to paralysis for some people.
Exactly, exactly. And the thing about rejection, the reason most people, shy people, feel that rejection in social situations is because they don't interact with the people that are available. And they do that happens enough times, and they no longer want to go to the places where the people are available. Even if they're work friends, it's a different environment if it's a social gathering. And so there's a couple of things that you can do in a social situation that will make your life much, much easier in terms of the shyness factor. One, again, I'd mentioned before, is I've become a master at asking questions. People, you will find, do like to talk about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them absolutely love it, and some of them you can't shut up. So be careful. But this technique
be careful
does
what
work.
You ask for, right?
Yeah, exactly. Be careful. You start asking a person about their lives, about their families, about things that they're passionate about. You know, the political season is winding up, and even though politics isn't supposed to be polite conversation, it certainly will get some people out of their shyness and into their personal power if they're feeling very strongly about something.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn to ask questions about a person's life, something they enjoy doing. You know, like, what's the most fun thing you've ever done? What's the best place you've ever visited? Have you ever read 1,000 places to visit before you die, and where do you want to go next? I mean, these are things that almost everybody will have something to say about.
Right. And it's a great technique because it puts the focus on them and takes it off you too then.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You may be shy. You may be quivering in your boots, but it doesn't look that way. A very interesting thing happened to Ted Koppel after the hostage crisis ended. They asked him to run for president. And he said, no, 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 no. He said, when I have to stop asking questions and start answering them, I'll be in trouble.
Okay.
You know, so he knew, I mean, of course, he's an interviewer, as are you, and you know, that's really the secret.
Right.
Just ask questions. And quite frankly, they can be very personal, and most people these days don't mind.
Yes.
My God, what don't we talk about on television?
Well, I'd agree with you there. So one of the things that just follows on from that very quickly is listening skills for those who are shy, because, you know, it's one thing to ask a question, but you say that shyness can really get in the way of being a good listener. So how do we make sure that we open up as a good listener?
One of the great things to do to both acknowledge the conversation, make yourself less shy, and remember what was said is to paraphrase it when you're talking with the other person. So you just got back from Bermuda. What was that like?
Okay.
Exactly. So you paraphrase a little bit of what it was they said. You were brought up in Nebraska, and now you here you are in Seattle. How did you do that?
Right.
So it's right. Just... So you incorporate their story in your next question.
Right. Sorry, go ahead.
No, but it helps you remember, and it helps them feel acknowledged. And when someone starts to feel that you're acknowledging them, a chemical goes off in their brain. It's called oxytocin, and it is known in some circles as the cuddle hormone. But what it really does is, is open a person up more to connecting with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. One of the things you suggest in the book is getting a dog. And I have to say, not that I'm particularly shy anymore. I used to be painfully shy, really painfully shy. But I'll talk to anyone. And, you know, when I walk around a park or something, I always say good morning to people. But it's amazing how many people do not reply or don't even make eye contact until I got my dog. And now everybody speaks to me. So, and that's one of the things you say in the book, you know, how dogs, animals open up a connection.
It is amazing the power of the pet. It is absolutely amazing. You know, my dog's on the back cover with me, and I can't go anywhere with her where somebody doesn't make a comment.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, it has really made me a much less anxious, less shy human being just having her around. And, you know, I know dozens and dozens of folks in my neighborhood. I've never been to their homes. I only see them on the street. And we don't even know each other's names, but we know each other's dogs.
Right, right, right. I can relate to that.
And in addition to that, you get the unconditional love of having the dog. But it's okay to bring the dog with you. We're becoming much more European about this. And, you know, dogs, you know, I see people taking their dogs everywhere. And quite frankly, I take mine most everywhere.
I do mine too, yeah.
You know, she goes to the office, all the clients know her and love her, and it's an important part of my life.
Mm. So let's just talk about, we've only got a minute left here, unfortunately, but I think this is important because when we're shy, we don't always speak up for ourselves. So tell us how we can get in the habit of doing that, because that can lead to all kinds of other issues like resentment and anger.
Well, it is very, very important to not allow yourself to be diminished, dissed, or abused. If anyone speaks to you in that manner, you have to have a rehearsed retort, because if you're a shy person, you might not. And the one that I use is, excuse me, I don't allow people to speak to me that way. I'm going to leave the room, goodbye.
Mm.
Or I'm going to get off the phone, goodbye.
Mm.
But you have to set strong boundaries that you don't allow yourself to be bullied or teased or put down, made to feel uncomfortable. That's only going to exasperate your shyness and make your time more difficult. So if that happens, if you're at a group and somebody is making snide remarks and you don't like it, you can always leave that little group. But if it happens directly to you, you need to stand up for yourself and have a retort. It's very, very important. And actually, one of the very first things I teach people who come to me to overcome their shyness.
Yeah. Very good. Well, the book is packed full. It's got 100 ways to overcome shyness.
Many more than 100. And they work. If one doesn't work for you, another one will.
Yeah,
that's
the thing here. They're very short passages here. It's like a couple of pages long for each suggestion here. So if you do suffer with shyness or know someone who does, this would be a great book for them to start helping them get over that.
Exactly. It's not a textbook. It's a pick up and go to any chapter and read it again when you need to. It's a compendium of tools.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Barton Goldsmith, I thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find out more about Dr. Goldsmith at bartongoldsmith.com. He has a website up there. You'll get to see a picture of his cute dog. And you know, I would second that, because like I said, everywhere I go, I can't walk anywhere without people stopping and saying, can I pet your dog? So, and Eric's smiling, I suspect he has the same with his dogs. So I want to thank each of you for being with us today. If you have questions or feedback or comments on any of today's guests or topics, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can email me at info@conversationslive.net. We're also on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, and of course you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook, when that's at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And that's it, I guess, until next week. So we'll see you then. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.